This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Brian Fernandez. Brian, it's a Friday. It is the 12th of January, because it's very exciting for us who work a five-day week, because it's the end of the week.
Yeah, and also I'm surprised how quickly the year has gone by. It's already 12 days into 2018.
Ah, well, okay. So 12 days, not I don't know, is it that significant?
It just seems like yesterday was New Year's.
Ah, well, okay. Well, I might see a doctor if I was you. Okay, now there have been some news flow over the night as you slept soundly. One of it is a return to a story from China of this 8-year-old kid, a student, who was dubbed Ice Boy by social media in China because images of him arriving at school with swollen hands, frost in his hair and eyebrows, really captured the imagination of a lot of Chinese netizens. And this was not primarily from a cute angle. It was from this is a sign of poverty in China. And, we often forget the story of poverty or persistent poverty in that nation because of the narrative of, extraordinary success over the last couple of decades.
And, it's the one of the reasons for that extraordinary success is really the tenacity of the people. If you look at this little boy, he's walking 4.5 kilometers a day and literally, in temperatures as low as -9 degrees Celsius, gets good grades in school. I mean, he gets like 99 out of 100 for most of his tests.
Yeah, apparently. And the images of his textbook being very clean and neat. But yeah, so you could sort of turn that on its head and say, oh, this is a story of tenacity. But the other side is, why is this boy having to do this in this day and age? And that, I think, is what Chinese netizens are talking about. They're talking about the persistence of poverty in a nation now that's supposed to have lifted itself out of a much older narrative, one of on which poverty was quite central.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. This news from Sri Lanka.
Yeah, so Sri Lanka is to allow women over the age of 18 to buy alcohol legally. Believe it or not, for the first time in more than 60 years, the law has been in place since 1955. I never knew that.
I've been to Sri Lanka a couple of times. I must say, I didn't know that either. And perhaps it doesn't affect tourists. But it seems extraordinarily patriarchal to suggest that women cannot buy alcohol, presumably because it is to protect them. But the Sri Lankan government, after years of being persuaded this is actually discriminatory, has moved in there. Also in the news, theft and two stories. One we picked up on a couple of days ago of the attempted heist at the Ritz Hotel in Paris. Apparently, the thieves, most of them, have been caught and much of the jewelry recovered. But it was very, very old style. They came in with hammers. They smashed things. They put it, the jewelry in bags, and they threw it at each other in bags. In fact, the only successful bag of jewels that was thrown out. To accomplices on a motorbike. That motorbike skidded or hit pedestrians, and they lost that bag as well. So not the most competent of
So comedy ISIS. Of errors by the sounds of it.
Yeah. Also, Italian police are investigating three organizers of Modigliani exhibition after it was found that most of the paintings, all but one actually, were fakes.
I'm surprised that, you may think that this story may emanate out of China, some distant province, somebody did this. But, for it to come from literally one of the heartlands of art in Italy.
Well, actually, there's a great history on art forgeries coming from places like Italy and France and the like, just because, in fact, that's where there's an interest in it and where forgers and good forgers, hone their skills. So, because they're very famous Mona Lisa forgeries and like, it's a wonderful history. Anyway, we'll be back with a discussion about short or tall people, or either, depending on who you are on this scale. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Blind Faith and Well, All Right. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Brian Fernandez. It's still very early in the morning. It's just 9 and a half minutes, or just 9 minutes actually, past 6 in the morning. It is the 12th of January, 2018. Brian, yesterday we spoke about a Japanese astronaut who mistakenly tweeted to the world that he had grown 9 centimeters, about 3.5 inches, after arriving at the International Space Station. He later corrected himself, saying that he in fact had grown only 2 centimeters. He blamed the error on a measurement mistake. It might have been also a fantasy issue with him. apparently, humans do grow taller in outer space by as much as 2 to 5 centimeters. Now, this is a biological fact, or a fact of, you know, of space travel that I had little knowledge of. But it made me think, Brian, you know, about the question of height. And, you know, and I suggested earlier that it might have been partly a wish fantasy on his part. I mean, do people generally wish to be taller? And what does it mean to be taller? I mean, you're taller in comparison to others, isn't it?
I think it's, and you're right, it's probably a comparison, comparatively taller to say, your peers. So in Malaysia, I'm 5'10", so 177 meters tall. So
he's exaggerating a little bit. Okay, go ahead.
And basically, in terms of the average Malaysian male, maybe I'm just slightly above average, but I've never sort of aspired to be taller, except when I think when I was a primary school student, because I was shorter than the girls even. Of course, you know, girls kind of grow up quicker. At that point of time, I felt a little bit insecure because I was shorter.
But and I wonder if people carry those insecurities into later life. Because as you can imagine, right, it really does matter how people treat you. I, in my cohort of kids at school, was the taller one. Because I'm born in January, and therefore the difference between me and somebody born in December is quite stark. Yes. In terms of, in developmental terms, right? And so height becomes one of the more obvious measures of the changes in your body. But do you think in Malaysian society there's a premium place on height? I mean, that we generally think of taller people as being better looking, for instance?
No, I think that broadly across the globe, and I think we did an article, we talked about an article some time back about how tall versus short people stacked up in different areas.
Stacked up?
Yes.
Yeah, nice metaphor there.
So okay. Then, you know, for example, taller men and women are considered more dominant, healthy, and intelligent, according to that study. And they're more likely to be considered for competitive jobs. And interestingly enough, they earn more money as well.
Well, you know, I find this study hard to believe. I mean, there's studies galore, right? But and apparently from the research that we've done, most of the studies come to the same conclusion. But I don't think this really is indicative of what happens in Malaysia, because I know a lot of very successful people who in this country who are actually quite short. And I've never encountered the tall, short thing as an issue at the office, at least in terms of hiring, in terms of promotions and the like. Not in journalism anyway.
I think in an office context, you know, I have a question mark. But if you, for example, are in a sales role, I think that if you go up and you're tall, you are very pleasant looking,
commanding,
that really helps you in your job on a day-to-day basis, because people are more likely to listen to you.
But I thought it was really the gift of the gab. When it comes to sales, it's your ability to speak. So it doesn't matter if it's coming from a speaker that's about 4 foot, you know, or that's 6 foot high. I mean, what's important is what comes out of your mouth. And what often people are charmed by is the quick-witted, the funny, the self-deprecating humor that sometimes they employ, whatever it is.
And that often comes out from shorter people to try to compensate, perhaps.
Oh, do you think
yeah,
so?
Yeah, I think so. It comes from a slight insecurity at the back of their minds,
I think.
And so they tend to manifest
itself. I think it's your above average height person identity that is foisting this on short people. It might not be compensation, because I think, you know, and in fact, as tall people can also stand out in an awkward way. And so if you're too tall or you're much taller than the average, people might look at you and think, oh yeah, you know, gala. You know, all these taunts that kids can make about tall people.
So I think particularly that would be relevant for women in particular. Whenever I've noticed that sometimes very tall women, if they're not very confident. They tend to hunch slightly. And that stems from the fact that the society makes fun of them because they're too tall.
Well, I think I see tall men hunch as well. And again, this is an attempt. And I think we all want to do this. We all want to blend.
Blend in.
Mostly. Yes. Most of us want to blend in, right? So whether it's your body mass, you're too thin or you're too fat, which is always a problem, and, you know, whether you're too tall or too short, everybody sort of moves in that direction. And I think it's interesting, though, that people also find compensation in their partners. So short people tend to choose tall people and vice versa. Tall people tend to choose shorter people. And so, you know, and there was this, a philosopher called Schopenhauer who suggested that this, in fact, is a trait in human beings, that people tend towards a kind of convergence point. So people are tall, seek out shorter people,
so
and vice versa.
Thin people then seek out fatter people.
Yeah. And, you know, you see that in all of the classic friendships that you have, you know, the Laurel and Hardy comedy duo. There's something that is pleasing to the human mind to see contrasts in pairs.
But wouldn't people draw attention to that more? Wouldn't that contrast actually draw attention to the differences more than anything else?
So, yes, absolutely, but in a pleasant way.
So
right?
Wouldn't people say things like, oh, isn't that an odd couple? You know, he's so thin and she's so fat. So I tend to disagree with you, Sharad.
Okay. Well, next up, we're going to be talking about circuses. Well, you know, and some human oddities, and maybe the whole question of whether circuses are good or not. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. That was REM with Finest Work Song. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Brian Fernandez. We'll continue our conversation on shortness, if you like. Some short people end up in the circus, as do tall people. Remember, you can always be part of this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Or tweeting us at BFM Radio. You know who else is coming to town, Brian? Bruno Mars. And you know what? He's pretty short. I mean, at least for American standards, he's pretty short. I think he's like 5'5".
Oh, I see. And you know, talk about another famous short person, Tom Cruise.
Yeah, well, do you know how tall he is?
I think he's around that height as well, 5'6" or something like
which
that.
Which is my father's height. And I think my father would have been quite the average height for someone of his generation. You know, I'm 2 or 3 inches taller than him. My brother, similarly so. But I think it might be the protein we ate.
Yeah, I think it's today the younger millennials and all are much taller as well than compared to previous years.
But the most important thing is, are they brighter and are they happier? Well, that's a question that we can come back to over and over again. Okay, recently in the news, the Catholic Pope has found himself in the midst of an animal rights controversy after he decided to act in a very charitable way. So his intentions are act charitable. And this was to distribute some 2,000 tickets to a circus. And he planned to distribute these tickets to the homeless and the needy, as well as refugees and prisoners. But animal rights activists citing unnatural detention and exploitation of animals, said that this was a bad idea.
Now, they said that basically they cited the Pope's 2015 encyclical on the environment and living creatures. A passage read that every act of cruelty towards any creature is contrary to human dignity.
Yeah, you know, an encyclical, of course, is a message or a memo that goes from the Pope to all his bishops, right? And so that's what an encyclical is. Basically, it's a statement of policy.
Yeah, but the thing is, so this gesture was come out in good faith. So the Vatican then said essentially the circus was meant as encouragement for people to overcome the harshness and difficulties in life that they so often seem so big and impossible to overcome. The people attending the circus would also get a box meal at the end of the show, and also there would be a mobile clinic outside the circus tent. So it really, it was all down from it came from the heart, literally.
Okay. Well, the circus also said that actually currently the laws that govern them mean that there are strict guidelines on the way in which animals are treated, and they're subjected to the law. They could be brought to court for animal mistreatment and such. But, you know, the anti-zoo, anti-circus thing is an article of faith with many animal rights activists. And I don't disagree with them. I think in principle, I think we all see that instances that, oh, we've grown up to see instances of cruelty and such. But does that mean those institutions are bad? And, you know, and whether you can sort of tar all circuses with the same brush.
Yeah, because a lot of circuses have also moved away from largely having, from animals being the primary source of entertainment to animals being a far smaller source. And then, in fact, like Cirque du Soleil, there's no animals in it completely. So I think that that's the evolution also in terms of how society views circuses. Circuses, I think, have been closing down over the last few years as well. So the days are numbered because I think, for example, America's best known, you've heard of the Ringling Brothers, right? Or P.T. Barnum, Barnum and Bailey. They closed in 2017 in May after 146 years of operation.
Yeah, and apparently they were subject to multiple suits by animal rights groups over the mistreatment of wild animals in their care. So it wasn't that people didn't want to go to them. It's just the burden of, you know, a litigious society where, you know, they were the subject of many lawsuits. I do think, though, you know, it's a difficult one for me because, you know, I do love animals, you know, and I mean, general, you know. But there is also this, I think, a strange and somewhat, you know, important hypocrisy to point out. A lot of people who say they love animals also eat them, right? So we eat those animals that we say, or we define the animals that deserve care as those that we don't eat, basically.
You see, Sharad, I have a different view. I'm an animal lover. I consider myself an animal lover.
Do you
lover.
Love chicken or lamb?
Chicken more. And lamb.
Oh, that kind of animal lover.
Yeah, that kind of animal lover. But the thing is this, I think circus have had their time. Circuses globally have had their time. And I think they should be phased out in terms of having animals.
Why?
In terms of entertainment. But I think there is still a place for zoos. So if you want exposure for young children and so forth, I think a zoo in the right environment, properly managed, is probably the right way to get people exposed to animals.
I think circuses can be properly managed with animals too. You know, they're a source of infinite fascination for a child. You know, Malaysia used to have the Royal Indian Circus come through, you know, every so often. And, you know, my uncles and aunts would take us to that. And it was the most extraordinary thing for a child. And it can be done well. It's just a question of management. And I tell you, you concede the circuses to animal rights groups, you'll end up conceding the zoos too, because it's an article of faith for them. Okay, taking us all the way up to the first bulletin of the morning, Dive and Under the Sun, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Cheap Trick with I Want You to Want Me. I'm Sure I Couldn't with me, Brian Fernandez. And of course, you know, you can join this conversation and us at any point in time by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 or tweeting us at BFM Radio. Brian, time to talk about Donald Trump. I mean, it's not my favorite subject, but he's in the news for something, maybe from a Malaysian standpoint, it's a bit odd, which is a medical checkup. Now, he's going for his first physical since taking office on January the 12th last year. And it's fascinating because I don't think Malaysian politicians ever get such a public airing of their checkups.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure of that. Well, so apparently this will be conducted by Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson. He will issue,
shouldn't it be conducted by a doctor?
Yeah, who's the chief physician. And will issue a public report on the exam, which will be held at the Walter Reed Medical Center in Maryland.
Yeah, so the question, of course, is, you know, when it comes to politicians and their health is, you know, where do you draw the line between their privacy, or their right to be have their medical status private, and where does it become a public issue?
But in this case, because you're the president of the most powerful nation in the world, or one of the most powerful nations in the world, it is your physical health, and actually, in this case, with Donald Trump, your mental health situation is very, very vital.
Yeah, it is maybe that too. I mean, though I'm not quite sure if the rationale behind this was pitched at, you know, America's global status. I mean, it might have been domestic concerns. But at any rate, there is this issue, and I believe, you know, some psychologists, and actually quite a number of them have come out to talk about Donald Trump's mental health. But to the extent that, you know, we all have problems, and especially in later stages of our lives, we might have all kinds of diseases. But does that make us incompetent for such office, right? I mean, so...
Well, if you have mental health
even
issues...
Even if he was dying, right? So even if, say, they said, oh, he had an issue and he might not live for another 5 years, but his term is only another 3 years, you know, will that disqualify him immediately? Should people be worried that somebody who's dying is in office?
No, Sharad, I think it's more an issue about, are there immediate healthcare concerns for that particular leader or individual? So, for example, let's just say he has some serious health issues that will impact him almost immediately. Then they need to have the conversation about vice president taking over.
Yeah, so once you have all those institutional mechanisms for succession, for distribution of duties in the event that somebody is incapacitated, you know, then this is really, it seems to me, not that important. I mean, it's a question of managing the situation. Now, one of the things that the American Constitution has, it actually has a clause in which the vice president, along with Congress, can remove a sitting president if he's deemed to be unfit for office. And I'm not sure if that's merely about his mental or organizational or, you know, ideological competence, but more importantly, medical one.
Yeah, so there's also an expectation from the public that the president, they want to know what healthcare state the president is in. So according to a Gallup poll in 2016, 51% of Americans feel that the president should release all relevant medical information. So that's a very important thing. You know, in a society like that, they want to know this.
Yeah, but I'm not quite sure, you know, the impulses of American society are a benchmark for the rest of us. I mean, you know, this is a society that now is jumping on Oprah Winfrey because she gave a speech at the Golden Globes. I mean, you know, turning to celebrity billionaires for leadership in a time of crisis seems to me a sign of some sort of pathology, this time a social pathology. But okay, never mind, you know, the American bashing. Just coming back to the more recent book on the Trump administration, Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury. Apparently, that also has converged to create this kind of, you know, storm of interest in Donald Trump's mental health.
Yeah, so basically in the book, he asserts that almost all the top staff and advisors in the White House believe that Donald Trump is actually mentally unwell. So obviously, the White House had to announce that he was going to have a physical, especially after he slurred some words during a speech announcing that the U.S. would recognize Jerusalem. So really, there's some issues, I think, behind the scenes.
He wasn't able to pronounce some words. Now, you know, most recently, he was also, you know, he went to a football game. And during that football game, because, you know, he's been attacking those athletes who kneeled during the anthem, mostly African-American athletes. And to show his solidarity, he went and he sang the national anthem. Apparently, the video of him captures him sort of mumbling or seemingly unable to remember the lines to the national anthem. So, because he got pilloried for that, saying, well, if you're going to talk about the national anthem in this way, at least remember the words.
Yeah, so here's the thing. So if I was a citizen of America, I would be concerned about all these issues and I would want to have more information.
If I was a citizen of America, I'd move to Canada. Thank you very much. Stay tuned. We'll be back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, the specials with Gangsta. That's a bit of a ska for you in the morning. I'm Sharad Kutan and Brian Fernandez with me. And of course, you can always join this conversation. Remember, you can WhatsApp us. But when you do WhatsApp us, remember, put your name there because we can't identify your number. Also, you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, Pakatan Harapan plans to introduce a monthly 100 ringgit unlimited travel card for public transportation commuters should they come to power. Part of the ongoing discussion about election promises, Serdang MP Ong Kian Ming said the initiative is needed to ease the burden of people and increase ridership as well as usage of public transport. Ong cited statistics that ridership for LRT Kelana Jaya line peaked in August with over 260,000 riders during the promotional month when LRT and MRT fares were slashed by 50%. In the subsequent month, it dropped by some 40,000 riders. And so the question is, there are two things here, right? One is cost of living and the alleviation of that through, you know, handouts and such. The other is, in fact, a public policy one where you're trying to encourage use of this new infrastructure that we have.
Yeah, so let's talk about the cost of living equation. This is really going to have 100 ringgit flat fee as a monthly pass is going to help the B40 tremendously, because a lot for the B40, transportation and basic necessities like food constitute the bulk of their expenditure. So there isn't really much left over for anything else. This will really help to alleviate that.
Yeah, the other thing, of course, I think is when you look at the B40 and its preferred mode of transport, they might be driving smaller cars, but I think many of them use motorcycles. Right? Motorcycles seem to be the preferred mode of transport for a lot of working class people.
Because it's low cost, yes.
Yeah, it's low cost, it takes you far. And also with all public transport in this country, at least with the city, there are connectivity issues and the cost of those connections, right? So it's not just the LRT, but it's the cost of the bus getting to the LRT and then getting from there to your destination. There's that, and and with that, you also have a question of the lack of reliability of those, what they call these buses.
Yeah, so the thing is, so 100 ringgit itself will make a tremendous difference to the B40. But let's not discount the fact that a lot of people will then start to, from a public good and reduction in the use of cars on the road, you're going to have a lot of people that are saying, hey, for 100 ringgit, literally that's less than the cost of parking, I'm going to leave my car at home and take public transport. Because essentially, that if we want to influence consumer behavior, that's a very good way to do that. And then from a public good perspective, we're going to get a huge return on investment on our investments in LRT infrastructure.
Right. So we spoke to economist Adli Amirul Amirullah for some reactions to the pledge. He's the coordinator for the economics unit at IDEAS, the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs. We asked him for his thoughts on this election promise and whether public transportation is high on voter lists of concerns.
Well, the main concern of the voters is cost of living. Anything that may affect cost of living is a list of concern for all the people or all the rakyat. However, public transportation is not a big contribution towards cost of living in Malaysia. Yes, we should admit by having affordable prices on public transportation, it will reduce some burden on the rakyat. However, this initiative will mainly benefit by the urban people and mainly in Kuala Lumpur and Selangor. How about the rural people and people in Sabah and Sarawak?
Well, we asked him how they can better target their public transportation policies to match what rural voters need.
Well, first they have to develop a better road, which is connected within the state itself. For example, if you take your journey from Kuala Lumpur to Kota Baru, for example, you can see a good, beautiful highway from here to Trukara Highway, and you went to Kuantan. Once you exit Kuantan and you are going towards the Kelantan through the Gua Musang Road, you can see how dangerous to some extent that it is not well developed. So if Pakatan really want to target transportation policy, they should maybe introduce a much more better route along the way towards to Kelantan, for example.
Finally, we asked him if this policy alone isn't effective enough to woo voters from all sides, will it at least encourage people in urban areas to use public transport more frequently?
Yes, it will encourage more people to take public transport if and only if our public transport works efficiently and well connected within and between the cities. Cheaper fare alone will not guarantee more ridership, because there is much more exogenous variable that may affect one's decision to take public transport. Pricing is just part of it. One of the problems other than cost in public transport is efficiency and convenience. Pakatan should focus on structural improvement if they really want to improve ridership of public transportation. In Japan, for example, a bus stop was located at least 300 meters from one another along city road. Furthermore, if the efficiency level of public transportation is poor, cheaper fare will not encourage more people to use public transport. For example, a person or you will not motivated to take public transportation if your total journey going to your office with public transport is much more longer than your total journey to go to your office with your own vehicle or other transportation alternative.
That was economist Adli Amirullah, coordinator for the economics unit at IDEAS, speaking about Pakatan's 100 ringgit unlimited monthly travel pass proposal.
Yeah, so interestingly, and he's got a very good point. I think transportation has to be looked at as an overall policy for whether it's Pakatan Rakyat or whether it's the government itself. So essentially, you know, one of the things is that connectivity between the LRT stations, for example, and your next point, buses are a very good, the main thing that are used right now. But the thing is it efficient? The other thing is also in areas where there's very low volume, you can't have a large bus. What's the solution for routes which are what they call thin routes, where there are very few riders?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting point. Also, I must say, as a public transport taker, somebody who doesn't own a car, doesn't know how to drive a car, you know, I always look from above as the train passes over all those traffic jams. And I'm looking down at all the schmucks in the cars thinking, I'm so lucky I'm riding the LRT. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. It is the 12th of January, 2018. Coming up to 7 minutes past seven. And remember, you can always be part of this conversation. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Please include your name so that we know who you are. Or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, over the past week, The Sun and Star have carried stories on cases of state children denied enrollment to schools because they didn't have a passport. 7-year-old Dashana as well as 10-year-old Ame are two children whose cases were highlighted in the dailies. We know there has been a happy ending for them. Today's cover of the Star shows that Dashana in a school uniform, not at the gate, but walking proudly to the classroom.
Well, there are also other cases that are to be resolved. Non-citizen and stateless children who have been unable to enroll in government schools since the beginning of the school term last week should be able to apparently do so in the next couple of days. This is according to the Prime Minister's Department Special Implementation Task Force Manager, G.K. Anandan, who helped Dashana register for the school.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, Brian, because that was quite shocking in the reports, was the magnitude of the problem of statelessness and how it affects children. I think we had a number a couple of days ago we pulled out and said something of the magnitude of 300,000. I thought that was extraordinary. And the public policy implications of having so many stateless children and for them not to have, say, access to school or maybe even healthcare and such. I mean, all that would be quite troubling. Anyway, we spoke to a lawyer and founder of Voice of Children, Chairperson Shamila Sekarin, and asked her why these cases happen in the first place. And is there a common situation at the start of the school year?
Yes, it is, but it also comes up periodically during the year, randomly. It's hard to say exactly why, because, you know, this is through the government and I can't speak for them. But what is really a worry is the fact that, you know, that we do not have, as a nation, as a government, we do not have a very clear policy on ensuring that every child receives an education. And this goes directly against our obligation under the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which Malaysia has ratified, you know, and it goes directly against our obligation under the Convention to make primary education compulsory and available free for all children. So the fact that, one, it is a repeated problem, but two, that it is a problem at all when we've signed on and we've ratified the Convention like over 20 years ago now, is a very worrying position to be in.
So we asked her to walk us through the process of what a stateless child needs to have to enroll in the school year.
When it comes to stateless children it's not just stateless children, it's non-citizen children who want to go to a government school, who are not going to a private school. So we're not talking about expat children. We're talking about children who are not Malaysian citizens but still want to go to our Sekolah Kebangsaan. What they have to do is every year they have to go to the Ministry of Education and pay a certain fee and get the receipt, basically. That basically says they paid this certain fee, which then they go back and give to the school that they want to go to and that has space for them, and submit that form, and only then can they register. So they have to, in a sense, register at the school every year. And one of the problems with this is sometimes if there is a delay for any reason in this process, then they may not be able to start on the first day of the school year.
That was lawyer and founder of Voice of the Children, Shamila Sekar, and she's the chairperson. Brian, we talked about this endlessly, and I think we're probably, the both of us are the same mind when it comes to this issue, that children are a resource, whoever they come from, you know, whatever their background is. If you have a really good education system and you give them the resources and you train them, they can be valuable to the society in which they live and to the economy as a whole. And yet it seems that there's a kind, these are barriers. I don't know if they're insurmountable barriers, but do we put too many hurdles in front of parents trying to register their children?
I think it's short-term thinking. It looks like there is a lot of barriers put in front of these stateless or non-citizens in order to register their kids. One of the things that's actually surprising for me is that the fact that they have to do it annually, that itself is such an onerous process. That's also, I'm sure, I can imagine being a parent, the anxiety that you have to go through just about, you know, every year at a certain time of the year when you have to re-enroll these kids. Will the school accept the kids, for example? They may not be obliged to do so.
Yeah. And I think also maybe we underestimate, as middle class, adults, the way in which working class adults, especially those who are disenfranchised, feel about officialdom, right? So the more red tape you throw in front of them, the more likely they are to, you know, want to avoid that. And that is the situation, because people in some ways can survive. I mean, you can, you know, not enroll your kids and then you could put them to work, you know, as soon as you feel that they're able-bodied. And what would be the consequence of so many? Remember, the quantum is huge.
300,000
of young people growing up without adequate education and, you know, kind of like existing in the lower rung and not having those resources for mobility. Right?
And I think it ignores the fact that I think the officials at large are ignoring the fact that this will then, as we've discussed previously, Sharad, lead to a lot of social problems further down the track. So you're essentially really kicking the can down the road in terms of a problem instead of relatively addressing the issue in a very low-cost manner, which is essentially let them get enrolled in schools.
Also, there's a question in this story about how various authorities and ministries speak to each other or don't speak to each other. Apparently, the Ministry of Education was caught off guard with this ruling from the Immigration Department. Now, so on Wednesday, Deputy Education Minister Dato' Chong Sin Woon said that the Education Ministry is seeking clarification from the Immigration Department over the new condition. Dato' Chong said the ministry would not wish to deny any child of basic education and said that the earlier policy worked well.
Yes, so yesterday, Deputy Prime Minister and Home Affairs Minister Dato' Sri Ahmad Zahid Hamidi said that the children awaiting approval for Malaysian citizenship have a right to attend government schools while their application is being processed.
Also, yesterday, Director General of Immigration, Dato' Sri Mustafa Ali, clarified that his department has never issued any circular prohibiting non-citizen children from entering school. He said non-citizen children should be allowed to enter school if the parents or guardians could produce all the documents required by the Education Ministry. So the question is, okay, so we need some sort of coherence in terms of a policy and approach to this issue.
I think the basic issue is the fact that I think the different government agencies and departments are not on the same page.
Yeah, and it's maybe in this regard that the media can be given a pat on the back for highlighting this and forcing a conversation between the various ministries in order to have everybody aligned. Fascinating stuff, and it's so nice to see those images of young people on the front page with smiles on their faces. Okay, we'll be back with more. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.